From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. It was the 1950s. He was one of the few African-American students at Pennsylvania's Swarthmore College. She was a white French teacher. They fell in love, married, at a time interracial marriage was banned in much of America. And a few years later, they were divorced. One of the couple's two children, Mark Whitaker, is managing editor of CNN Worldwide and the former editor of Newsweek. In a memoir, he explores his unusual family tree, his rift with his father, and why it's never too late to heal even the oldest wounds. Mark Whitaker joins us to talk about what he discovered. First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Three somewhat positive reports on the economy are out this morning. New claims for unemployment benefits have declined a bit, slipping below the 400,000 level for the first time in 5 weeks. Economist Hugh Johnson.
It was better than we expected, and I think is consistent with the view that the employment situation is improving. But it's not improving at a very fast pace, but nevertheless, it's improving.
The Labor Department also says the productivity of American workers rose in the third quarter, the first increase this year. And the Commerce Department says orders to U.S. factories were up for a third straight month in September, a gain that was not expected by analysts. Leaders of the world's largest economies are meeting today in the resort city of Cannes on the French Riviera. President Obama was welcomed there by an honor guard. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the leaders are looking for ways to prevent the Greek debt crisis from spreading.
Greece is not even a member of the G20, but its debts are nevertheless a big focus for the world leaders gathered here. President Obama said French President Nicolas Sarkozy and his European counterparts have taken some important steps with their plans for a financial firewall is designed to protect countries such as Italy and Spain.
Here at the G20, we're going to have to flesh out more of the details about how the plan will be fully and decisively implemented.
Greece has complicated the talks with its demand for a public vote on the rescue plan. The U.S. economy has a lot riding on the outcome, but the administration insists this is Europe's problem to solve. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Cannes.
Police in Oakland, California have arrested dozens of people early this morning after masked vandals set fires and broke windows. Four protesters were hospitalized. Police in riot gear surged into the area and are using tear gas and concussive grenades to disperse crowds. The clashes follow a day of mainly peaceful demonstrations by thousands of Occupy Oakland protesters who effectively shut down the Port of Oakland last night. A new report finds that not only has poverty in the U.S. grown over the past decade, but it has also become more concentrated in certain areas. NPR's Pam Fessler reports the research was done by the Brookings Institution.
Almost 11% of the nation's poor live in what are called extreme poverty neighborhoods, where more than 40% of the residents are poor. That's a higher percentage than in the year 2000, according to a new study by the Brookings Institution. Researchers say this concentration of the nation's poor makes it more difficult for those living in these areas to pull themselves up. Such neighborhoods tend to have higher crime, poorer schools, and fewer job opportunities. The biggest increase in concentrated poverty came in the South and Midwest, regions of the country that were especially hard hit by recent economic downturns. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks are holding on to gains on Wall Street. The Dow is up 95 points. The Nasdaq is up 18. This is NPR News. A ferry boat carrying 1,200 passengers from Jordan to Egypt has sunk in the Red Sea after fire broke out aboard. NPR's Saraya Sarhadi Nelson reports from Cairo that, amazingly, no one was killed.
The fire erupted on the Pella, some 20 miles from the Jordanian port city of Aqaba. The ferry belongs to AB Maritime, a joint venture founded a quarter century ago by the governments of Jordan, Egypt, and Iraq. Egyptian state TV reports everyone was rescued. Egyptian naval vessels and military aircraft helped transfer the rescued passengers to the Egyptian port city of Nuweiba, which is where the ferry was headed. Most of those on board were Egyptian expatriate workers returning home from neighboring states for the Muslim holiday Eid al-Adha. Saraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Cairo.
British drug maker GlaxoSmithKline has agreed to pay the U.S. government $3 billion to settle a case that dates back at least 8 years. Larry Miller in London reports this is a record fine for the pharmaceutical industry.
GlaxoSmithKline says the settlement covers both civil and criminal liabilities. U.S. investigations centered on the company's sales, marketing, and compliance procedures of 9 drugs, including its controversial diabetes drug Avandia. Among the allegations that the company marketed some drugs illegally and defrauded the Medicaid program. The investigation also focused on how Glaxo represented to the FDA and to doctors the risk of suicide for those taking one of its drugs. There are also allegations over how sales bonuses were targeted. The company says its procedures have now changed. The fine will be paid out of existing cash reserves. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
And I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections and celebrating National Adoption Month at aecf.org.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's in Maine on a station visit and will be back on Monday. Children often see their parents' faults and vow never to repeat them. Journalist and editor Mark Whitaker made many such observations growing up as the biracial child in a broken home. But when he began to write his family history, he found more to admire than he'd realized. His new book is titled My Long Trip Home, and Mark Whitaker joins me in the studio. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
It's good to be here, Susan.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation with your questions or comments. Our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850. We'll go to the phones in just a little while. You can always send us an email at drshow@wamu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So your mother, tell us about her.
My mother was born in French Africa, the child of two Protestant missionaries. Her mother came from America, from Worcester, Ohio, and her father came from Paris and was French. My mother was raised in Cameroon and Madagascar up until about the age of 9. She was the oldest of what turned out to be 8 sisters. When she was 9, they moved to France, and my grandfather, who was a French Protestant minister, in addition to a missionary, eventually became one of the religious leaders in a little town in the mountains of central France called Le Chambon-sur-Lignon. And after the Germans occupied France, Le Chambon became a center under the direction of my grandfather and his fellow pastor there, a sort of underground railroad for Jews who were hiding from the Nazi and the Vichy police. By the end of the war, they hid thousands, literally thousands of Jews. However, my grandfather, at the very beginning of all of this, was very concerned about the fact that the Germans in the countries that they were occupying were denying educational opportunities to girls. So he decided that he was going to send his daughters to America to live with American families during the war. And they arranged for my mother, who was 14 at the time, and 5 of her younger sisters who were old enough to travel, got them on a boat with other refugee children on a boat that arrived in America in 1940. And my mother was placed with a family in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, where she finished high school and went to college and later became a professor. And that's how my mother came to America.
And so that in itself could be a book, the story of your mother and her parents. Your father also has his own amazing story. Tell us about him.
Well, my father was black, raised in Pittsburgh, the son of two undertakers. So he grew up in a world that was a cross between August Wilson and Six Feet Under. And I discovered, actually, I didn't know this. My granddad, my father's father, had suffered a stroke when I was very small. So I just remember him as sort of a sad figure in a wheelchair, unable to communicate very well. But in the course of reporting this book, I discovered what a force of nature he was. He was born on a tenant farm in Texas in 1898, the 13th child of a former slave, who literally started school in a one-room log cabin school, was educated only through the seventh or eighth grade, and then made his way in his teens north as part of the Great Black Migration that Isabel Wilkerson and others have written so well about, to Pittsburgh. Started as a laborer in the steel plants in Pittsburgh would have been the late teens, early 20s. But then eventually, and encountered a lot of racism, and I discovered actually a document that he had written when he was in a nursing home late in life where he described a lot of his early adventures, but then got a side job as a chauffeur for a white funeral owner who was concerned that with all these black folks arriving in Pittsburgh, he didn't want to have to bury black folks because it would be bad for his business with white folks, so that what Pittsburgh needed were some black undertakers. So he actually set my granddad up in business, which is how my granddad became an undertaker. So that's the world my father grew up in, but he became involved. He was raised as a black Baptist, but his Sunday school teacher suggested when he was in high school that he investigate summer work camp for students run by the Quakers. So my father started to go to Quaker work camps and sort of became very interested in Quakerism, started to worship as a Quaker still in his teens, and that's what led him to apply to Swarthmore College, a venerable Quaker school, outside of Philadelphia, and in the early 50s, he enrolled as the only black male student at Swarthmore College, which is what he was when my mother, who at that point was a professor at Swarthmore, met him and they fell in love.
So they had a sort of surreptitious romance while he was still a student there, and got married soon after he graduated. These days, interracial marriage increasingly common. How unusual was it at that point?
Well, it was still, first of all, illegal, I think, in two-thirds or so of states in America. Statistically, I think it was very rare. As you say, my parents' relationship was sort of doubly illicit because not only was it interracial, but it was also between a student and a teacher. They met when my mother, who oversaw the French Club, decided that she wanted to help the students put on a play entirely in the original in French. And they needed somebody for the part of a tribal chieftain. And my father's roommate suggested that my father might play the part, although the problem was he didn't speak French, which is, my mother had to tutor him in French, which is how they first got to know each other. It's interesting. People ask me when they hear about this, well, how did the families on both sides react? And the fact is that my father's parents were very accepting of my mother when they first met her, and as were my mother's parents of my father. The university, however, and particularly the university president, was not so enlightened when eventually it came out that they were involved. The president of Swarthmore at the time was named Courtney Smith, and my mother was coming up for tenure at the time that they their relationship came public, and Courtney Smith tried to block her tenure appointment, and my father, who through his Quaker contacts knew some civil rights leaders, got them involved. Bayard Rustin, among others, you know, who later organized Martin Luther King's March on Washington, got involved, and eventually they kind of Courtney Smith backed off, and my mother got tenure, but it was a little touch and go there for a while.
So it's a wonderful love story in a way. Against the odds, they get married, they have two children, but then they get divorced, and that started a very tough time for you and your mom.
Yeah, well, you know, and this is interesting because, you know, the part of the story that I've just told you is the part that always led people when they heard about it to say, you know, that could be a book someday. And one of the reasons I was reluctant to actually do that for many years was that there was a second part of the story, which is what happened ultimately to their marriage and then after they broke up. You know, and it's a story that, you know, my father got involved with other women. They moved to Princeton, where he had become the first black graduate student in the Department of Politics at Princeton, on his way to becoming an African scholar. But Princeton then, perhaps now as well, is still a pretty heavily drinking town, and they both started to drink more. There was more fighting. And then eventually my father was offered a job at UCLA. And my mother gave up her tenured position at Swarthmore to follow him. Within a year after they arrived in UCLA, my father asked for a divorce. It was very acrimonious. My mother hated L.A. She, you know, barely knew how to drive. She tried to sort of patch it up, and they went to therapy and so forth and so on, but ultimately it didn't work out. And she brought my brother and me back to the East Coast. And my father was supposed to play child support and, you know, was very unreliable in that regard. So she really had to, you know, from then on, raise us on our own. And, you know, it's interesting because that was the story. I started to overeat. I became eventually almost 100 pounds overweight. That was the difficult part. But it's interesting, you know, now that I've written the book and people are reading it, that's the part that people say, well, I've lived that story, you know, being raised by a single mother, having a father who left us, struggling with all of those things. So, you know, that may be the more universal part of the story.
And the story, essentially, your book is really about coming to terms with your hatred for your father. Is that right? I mean,
well, I wouldn't. Well, you know, what I do is sort of trace the journey of my feelings towards my father. And one of the things that I think is important to say is that, you know, I think my memoir is different than a lot of memoirs, in that you know, rather than try to settle scores or be melodramatic, I really approach this as a reporter, and it was a reporter's attempt to really understand what had happened to my parents and the effect that it had had.
We're talking to Mark Whitaker about his new book, My Long Trip Home. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go to the phones. Our lines are open, 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page with USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio is Mark Whitaker. He's Executive Vice President and Managing Editor of CNN Worldwide. He was formerly the Washington Bureau Chief for NBC News and the editor of Newsweek. He's written a new memoir. It's called My Long Trip Home. And Mark, you were saying before the break that you approached this as a reporter would. How did you go about researching your family's history?
Well, you know, I woke up. My father died in the 2 days after Thanksgiving, 2008. And a year later to the day, in the middle of the night, I woke up and I said, you know, I want to try to write a book about him and about our family. And I started writing from memory, but realized very quickly that there were a lot of things that I didn't remember very well, or I didn't know, or I thought I knew, but maybe I was wrong. And, you know, after spending 30 years as a reporter, you know, you want to find out what the truth is. So I decided to undertake this as a reporting project, doing all the things that a reporter would do, finding all of the sources and subjects who were still alive, who had lived through these events, arranging to interview them, asking them for letters and documents, a lot of which they had forgotten that they had. Going through those letters and finding keys to various secrets and so forth that perhaps they had forgotten, but I was able to then go back and interview them again. Researching and finding out more about the worlds that that my parents and their grandparents lived through. This is a book. The backdrop of this book goes from Black Pittsburgh to the Civil Rights Movement to the Black Power Movement, World War II France, the sort of the feminist movement, which later, you know, after my parents got divorced, became very important for my mother in terms of coming to terms with what had happened. So, you know, I think I did a lot of research in the sort of surrounding historical events as well.
Now, was the attitude of your family members when you came and said, tell me about this or tell me more about that, was it, great, we want the record to be clear, or was it, why are you digging up all this stuff about our family?
Well, you know, it's interesting. At first they said, well, a lot of them said that they didn't remember the events very well, and partly because some of them were painful. But I said, look, you know, let me come and talk to you. Because a lot of the sources were elderly, I always made it a point to arrange to interview them early in the day so they'd still, you know, be wide awake and have a lot of energy, to make sure that they didn't have other things they had to get to that day so that once we got going, they would have time. And it turned out that actually they remembered a lot more than they thought they did. I also found, you've probably found this as a reporter, that a great way to sort of get things out of people is, you know, when you either present something that other people have told you or that you think you know, but they think is wrong, then all of a sudden their memory becomes very sharp. But, you know, I think that in a way, approaching it as a reporter, not being judgmental, not saying, why did you do this to me? Why did you do this to each other? First of all, it gave me a little bit of the detachment that I think I needed to go back and relive these events. But I think it also helped the interview subjects, too, in terms of, I think they realized that I wasn't really trying to get this out of them to pass judgment. And indeed, in the book, I don't pass judgment.
And was there anything that you uncovered or discovered that came just as such a surprise, something you just did not understand or realize?
Well, I really hadn't known that much about my father's father. I knew that my father had a very difficult relationship with him, and he had been described as a difficult man. What I didn't understand is just how unbelievably both enterprising and tough and charismatic he was. I mean, you know, really to start in a tenant farm in Texas and make your way and become a prominent undertaker. And then he actually got divorced from my grandmother and fell on hard times and had health problems and lost his business, but still came back after suffering a heart attack to get on his feet again as a businessman, then suffered a stroke, but still managed to hang on for 20 years. But, you know, he was very tough on my dad. And my dad always, I don't think it's a stretch, I didn't hate my father. I went through a lot of difficult periods with him. But I think my I think it's fair to say that my father did hate his father. But I think that was turned out, unfortunately, to be the root of a lot psychologically of a lot of my father's problems. He ended up being in many ways like his father. But, you know, my father, who eventually became a chronic alcoholic to the point of losing prominent university jobs and suffering from the DTs that I had to nurse him through when I was a teenager and so forth. You know, I think his conflict with his father played a role in that. And it was one reason why I was determined, both while my father was living later on after he stopped drinking, but then ultimately in writing this book, to come to a point of reconciliation with my father and understanding so that I wouldn't sort of repeat that generational pattern.
And you started the book after your father had passed away.
Right.
Do you regret that it's not a process that you'd gone through while he was still alive?
Well, you know, the fact is I had, when people first started suggesting that I might write a book about my parents, he was still alive and I approached him. I write about this towards the end of the book, and he had a very sort of characteristic response. He said, well, he said, I suppose I'll agree to talk to you on one condition. He said, I don't want to be the villain of the piece. Now, sort of ironic given that, you know, he first met my mother acting in a play. But, you know, first of all, that shows, that line itself shows just, you know, how erudite my father was. And, you know, he always had a way with sort of phrases and words and so forth. But he was also quite defensive. And I think it would have been actually very difficult to talk to him about these events. But, you know, he was a very charming man who I think liked to be the center of attention. So I like to think that at the end of the day, since he is a very central figure in this book, that he would have liked the fact that he's getting a lot of attention now in the reviews.
Let's go to the phones. We'll invite our listeners to ask us a question, to make a comment. We'll go to Marcella first. She's calling us from Lansing, Michigan. Marcella, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, thank you so much for having my call. I'm the mother of two biracial children, and their father and I have made a very conscious effort to have them embrace the fact that they're biracial, not to just identify with one race or the other, which seems to be kind of the opposite of what a lot of very prolific people in, you know, our society are doing. Like, you know, Halle Berry seems to identify herself with more the African-American side. And my question for Mark is, what do you seem to identify with? Do you tend to identify yourself with more one race or the other, or do you embrace the fact that you're biracial?
Well, you know, this is a terrific question. You know, the fact is, when I was growing up, there were so few of us that it almost wasn't an issue whether you were black or biracial. It was just that you sort of felt alien, really, you know, so different from everybody else. But I write about the fact in the book that by the time I became a teenager and I was in high school and in college in the 70s, there was all of this pressure to so-called self-define as black. For biracial kids, again, who are still not that great a number at the time, but even for a lot of black kids who I met in high school and college, who had actually grown up in very integrated circumstances and gone to integrated schools and some of the same schools that all the white kids had gone to. And yet when they showed up at, you know, I ended up going to Harvard, you know, in the mid to late 70s, felt this great pressure to sit at the black table, to live in the black house, to have a black experience. And, you know, you see this, you mentioned Halle Berry, but I think you see this in Barack Obama. You know, his story, and as told in his autobiography, is largely about somebody who really probably grew up, had even less exposure to American black culture than I did, or a lot of kids did, because his father, first of all, left when he was very young and came from Africa, and yet, you know, clearly decided that he had to very consciously define himself as a black man. You know, so look, my father always told me, there were two things about my father. I mean, on the one hand, He never wanted to be confined by being black. And obviously, he grew up in an era where society was confining you in that way, and he was determined not to allow society to do that. But on the other hand, he identified strongly. He was proud of having come from Pittsburgh. He became an Africa scholar. And he always told me, look, you know, the fact is, you know, in America, if you have any black blood, you know, you are black. That is how, you know, race has been defined. And you have to be embrace that and be comfortable with it. But at the same time, I never felt that I had to in any way deny the white side of my heritage either. And I've got to say that I am very heartened and encouraged that there is a generation now of kids who have grown up biracial who feel that they don't have to choose. And that actually the latest census results show that the growth in the number of biracial people who are self-identifying as biracial has been greater than the growth in the number of people who identify as African American. So it's obviously still from a numerically low base, but I just think that's great that people, you know, and I don't pass judgment. You can do it either way, but that people feel that they have that, young people feel they have that freedom, I think is terrific.
Marcella, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Jeremy. He's calling us from Raleigh, North Carolina, I think has a related comment. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Good. Yeah, I had a quick question. I am biracial, well, multiracial. My father was black and Hispanic, and my mother is white. Mm-hmm. And in high school, I had somewhat kind of pressure on me, in class sometimes. Like, you know, pretty much all through high school, I would just be hanging out. And they would lean over and just be like, you know, what are you?
And Jeremy, how would you answer that?
Well, I think the one thing I told them was, I guess I'm me, you know, and I wanted to ask the panel, what did he get any kind of questions like that? And how did he respond?
All right, Jeremy, thanks so much for your call.
Yeah, I encountered a lot of that, particularly once I started to go to school. But, you know, again, I think partly because, my father, for all of his problems and the problems we had together, was someone who always sort of insisted that I should be my own person. I just felt free to have the friends that I wanted to have, and some of them were black, but you know my two college roommates, one of them was Hispanic, and the other one was a Southerner from West Virginia, I always felt very determined to take full advantage of all the opportunities I had to meet different kinds of people rather than to just limit myself to one group.
We also have an email from Philip who writes, as a mixed-race person who wrote his master's thesis on the subjects of racial identity in 1993, I am glad to see that we are illustrating our proto-American culture as I anticipated. Thank you for adding your voice. I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking phone calls, 1-800-433-8850. You know, Mark, you mentioned Barack Obama's experience. And I know that when Diane had a reader's review panel talking about Barack Obama's book about his father, you were on the show.
I was,
on that panel.
Yeah, ironically.
It does seem like there are some real parallels between your experience and his experience.
Well, there are, in the sense that, you know, his parents were interracial. They came from the academic world. His father was both very brilliant but also very self-destructive, as was mine. I think the major difference, besides the fact that he's the president of the United States and I'm just, you know, someone who's had a career in journalism, is that he never really knew his father. You know, his father left him and his mother when he was a small child. He only met him a couple of times after that. So his book is really about the search for identity, how he learned to be a man and a black man in the total absence, really, of a father. My story is much more about a very complicated 50-year relationship with my father, also with my mother. And I'm going to thank you for sort of starting with my mother, because I think she is She was a less flamboyant character than my father, but in some ways I think the hero of this book for people who read it. I went through many complicated, I found out I worshipped my father as a child. I found out actually in the letters and so forth that I collected and the interviews that I did how much I worshipped him. I was very depressed and hurt when I was separated from him, which led to, you know, my eating problems and becoming very overweight for much of my childhood. When he reentered my life in my teens and I deeply wanted to have a relationship with him, he was falling apart with his drinking. And then when he finally gave up drinking and pulled out of that, I was making my way, you know, with my own career, my own family, sort of trying to prove that I could be everything that he wasn't, which made it very competitive for that period of my adulthood. And it was really only late in his life, after he retired, that we started to spend more real quality time together, get to know each other. And at that point, he actually gave me a lot of advice, because my father was a very brilliant man, despite all of his, you know, sort of personal demons, that I valued at the time, but that I valued even more as I went back and remembered and saw, you know, how right he was about a lot of the things that he advised me on.
Our first callers were interested in the question of how one self-defines. And interesting that President Obama has made it clear that he defines himself as an African-American, as a black man, even though he is, you know, the definition of a biracial person. What do you think about that?
Well, look, you know, again, I don't pass judgment. I think I think people have a right to sort of embrace the identity that they want to embrace. And I think that, you know, with President Obama, I think there were a lot of different, you know, he wanted to have a clear identity. I think it also had to do with moving to Chicago and becoming part of that community. A huge part of it was meeting Michelle Obama, Michelle Robinson, and becoming sort of part of her family too. But, you know, look, I mean, I think it had certain political benefits too, and I think it was clear from a fairly early age that he had ambitions to be a public figure.
We're talking with Mark Whitaker. He's the author of a new book, My Long Trip Home, a family memoir. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go back to the phones. We'll read some of your emails. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. By the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the Great Tech War of 2012, we talk with Farhad Manju about how Apple, Google, Amazon, and Facebook are on the verge of war against each other. Manju's article about this is in Fast Company. He's a technology columnist for Slate. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. With me in the studio is Mark Whitaker. He's the author of My Long Trip Home, a family memoir. He's also the executive vice president and managing editor of CNN Worldwide. He was formerly the Washington bureau chief for NBC News and the editor of Newsweek. You know, we've gotten some emails on this topic. Let me just take one of them. This particular one is from Fran. She says, several years ago, I saw a documentary on PBS hosted by Bill Moyers. The film was produced by a young American man who grew up in New York City. As an adult, this young man was told by his parents that they were Jewish and had been sheltered in that little Huguenot town in central France that your guest speaker mentioned. I'm wondering if Mark Whitaker is a descendant of any of the clergy who protected the Jewish children hiding there.
I was. My grandfather was named Edouard Theis, T-H-E-I-S, which is my mother's maiden name. And he was one of two Protestant pastors who were the leaders in that village. The other one was named André Trocmé. And they met as divinity students in Paris when they were studying to be clergymen. And eventually, when the war broke out and the Germans occupied France, they took it upon themselves to literally organize these villagers who, you know, were just ordinary farmers and so forth and so on. They had a whole system where they would, when Jews and other refugees were sent to them or arrived, they would sort of place them with villagers around the town. And, you know, this became a famous story. There's a very good book called Less Innocent Blood Be Shed, which was written about it, several movies, a movie called Weapons of the Spirit. My grandparents, both of them, my mother's parents, are now, were named Righteous Gentiles by the State of Israel and are honored in Yad Vashem and in the Holocaust Museum here in Washington for that.
You mentioned the advice you got from your father and how only over time did you come to realize how valuable or how right he would be. And, you know, when in your book you write about when you were named the editor of Newsweek, your father said, so you'll be Newsweek's first black editor. Are you ready for all the attention and expectations that will come with that? Were you?
I wasn't really. You know, I had started working for Newsweek as a summer intern when I was in college and really risen through the ranks. And I thought sort of ultimately earned the job of editor sort of the old-fashioned way, doing all the jobs that, you know, you do on the way up the ladder. I had covered a fair number of stories. You know, I covered the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa and wrote the cover story when Nelson Mandela was released from prison. I had written a fair amount about racial issues around the O.J. Simpson trial and some other big stories we had covered. But I also covered, you know, many other stories as business editor and an international writer and so forth and so on. And it surprised me. My father was absolutely right that when I was named the editor, that was the entire focus, the first African-American editor of a national news magazine. There was a reporter who came to our news meeting shortly after I took over, and the lead of his story about how unusual it was to see a room full of white journalists taking direction from a black editor. And, you know, what I would say when people ask me about that is that I was proud of that and thought that perhaps I could, from my given my background and perspective, be a champion for some smart coverage about racial issues and other related issues. But at the end of the day, I wanted to be the best editor of Newsweek that I could be, period, not just the best black editor.
How was it that you ended up leaving Newsweek?
Well, you know, I had been the editor for almost 8 years, and Don Graham, who then owned Newsweek, the Graham family, the Washington Post company, approached me and said, you know, I think that increasingly the future of journalism is going to be online and on the web. The Washington Post had bought Slate, this very clever online publication from Microsoft, and they were having good business results of that. So He asked me to take on a new job developing other editorial websites along the lines of Slate. Which I did, and, you know, I was kind of busy working at that. But then I was approached about 6 months later by NBC News, by Steve Kappas, who had just taken over the president there. And, you know, I was itching to get back into just, you know, real reporting. And I had grown up watching NBC and Huntley Brinkley and so forth, and I thought it was a great opportunity. I think, you know, in this day and age, if you care about news, you have to care about television news and an opportunity to have an influence there.
Your father, though, had talked about Shakespearean-type intrigue. And with your leaving of Newsweek, did you feel betrayed?
A little bit. You know, I mean, I think that, look, my father was a student of politics, and, you know, he understood that things were always political, and that as soon as I became editor, it was a great opportunity, but there would also be people who resented me, people who had their knives out for me, people who would be gunning for my position. You know, he turned out to be right about that. You know, I had a very ambitious deputy who, you know, I think wanted my job and, you know, I think became impatient. And part of the story of my leaving Newsweek also had to do with that. You know, I think that's sort of what my father had been warning me about over the years. And he turned out to be right about that. But, you know, it turned out okay for me.
You're at CNN now. There is such a battle among the cable networks. We talked about racial identity. There's a lot of ideological identity going on with the cable networks. What do you hope to do at CNN?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When CNN approached me, it was interesting. I was finishing this book, finishing the writing of this book. And I realized that there was an opportunity, I thought, uniquely at CNN, given for what it stood for in the past, to have another phase in my career where I'd really get to act on some things that had deep personal meaning for me because of my background. The first thing was the coverage of international news. You know, and given my family background, the fact that my mother was French, my father was a scholar of Africa, you know, I think that it's very important for Americans to understand what's going on around the rest of the world. CNN is the one television news organization that has really continued to expand in that area. It has an international network. And I thought, you know, if I could come to CNN and convince them to bring more of their international coverage to their domestic airwaves, that would be a good thing. I also thought that in this whole issue of how we cover America as it becomes more multicultural, as we move towards an America by mid-century that's going to where, you know, traditional minorities are going to be in the majority, that CNN also, I think, could play a major role in covering that in a smart way and not a from a point of view of denial or thinking that this is America is falling apart because of all of this. And finally, you know, a lot has been written about CNN being in the center politically. You know, my parents had, you know, their own political views, but they were always taught me, both directly and by example, to be skeptical of anybody's party line. You know, I think that that's what CNN should stand for when it comes to covering politics.
I wonder if you have concerns, though, that Fox has become such a powerful force with many conservative anchors appealing to people of conservative views. MSNBC has some straight news shows, but also some shows that are by very liberal anchors. And I wonder if you worry about kind of the American population sorting itself out so that not only do they disagree on the proper policy ahead, but they disagree on what the news is or who they believe in telling the news.
Well, look, you know, I think that phenomenon of people being able to choose their sources of news is just a reality today. And I don't think, I mean, the day when there was one institution or a handful of institutions that were considered the gold standard and everybody kind of accepted their version of the news, that's just gone. We don't live in that world. But I do feel very strongly that there has to be an alternative to just a sort of, you know, lockstep, knee-jerk political coverage on either the right or the left. And I think that certainly in the cable news world, I think, you know, that's what CNN stands for.
And let me just ask one last question. I think one of the things that's frustrating to some people who want to get news from cable is the amount of attention paid to things like the Amanda Knox trial or the Michael Jackson's doctor's trial. Do you think that CNN has overdone its hour after hour coverage of some events like that?
Well, I've got to say, I won't speak for what CNN did in the past before I arrived there, but I don't think that's happened since I've been there. We have a sister network, HLN, which gives a lot of that kind of coverage to some of those stories. But the fact is, despite some skepticism from some of my colleagues when I arrived about my crusade on behalf of international news, we've done more international coverage than we have in a very, very long time at CNN this year, and our ratings are up 50%. Now, there have been some pretty dramatic foreign news stories, but I think that's evidence that if you do it well, it doesn't necessarily have to be a ratings killer.
Let's go back to the phones and talk to Akeem. He's calling us from Houston. Hi, Akeem.
Hi. Yes, I have a question for your guest. I am from Africa. I just want to know in what way is the fact that him being biracial, in what way has that opened the door for him or closed any door against him?
All right, Akeem, thanks very much for your call.
Well, one of the interesting themes, I think, in the book is to see what the opportunities and what the obstacles were for my grandfather compared with my father compared with me. All of us, the one thing that all three of us share in common was, I think, a great deal of ambition and desire to sort of expand into new worlds. My grandfather ran up against, the obstacles of racism of the time over and over again in a way that he, although he was a pioneer in his own right, I think ultimately found very, dispiriting. My father had that early in his life, but then had all kinds of doors open once you sort of got into the age of the post-civil rights age of affirmative action, but unfortunately at a time when he couldn't take full advantage of them because of his personal problems. I freely admit in the book that being a person of color has provided opportunities for me. You know, when I was first hired as an intern at Newsweek, they were specifically lurking for black kids and other diverse kids, who might fit in and do well at Newsweek. You know, I also think that growing up in two worlds, in a white world and a black world, had two advantages for me. One is it made me appreciate both sides of those stories and indeed different cultural viewpoints in general. But also, I was just comfortable around white people. You know, and the fact is you still, as a black executive today, have to live in a world that's largely white. And it helps when, you feel at ease around white folks.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go back to the phones. We're taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Tito is calling us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Tito, thanks for holding on.
Hi. I have a question for Mark Whitaker. I was a student at the Le Collège Sevenal, and when your grandfather was the director of the school, and I knew him a tiny bit, as much as a student might know the director. And then later I was involved with the school. Now I work with Hispanics who are not legal in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like there's some lessons maybe from there to here because the school was taking in all sorts of people who didn't have papers, who were traveling, like as you said, on the Underground Railroad. But it seems like nowadays we have the same phenomenon. And I was wondering if you had any insights from your background about what's happening with this enormous number and this huge demographic change that's happening in the United States right now.
Yeah. Tito, before Mark addresses that, can you tell us just a little more about how you happened to be a student at that school?
My parents had a year overseas, and they sought out Le Collège Sevenal as a place for me and my brother to be students. So we were there. I was in the seconde, and my brother was in another, he was in troisième, and so we were students there for the last year that Whitaker's was the director.
All right. Well, that's so interesting. Thanks so much.
He was referencing the grades. Those are what they're called. I was actually in troisième, which was, I guess, the equivalent of ninth or tenth grade when I spent a year in France. Just a little bit on the Collège Sevenal. My grandfather in this little town not only was the religious leader, but actually founded and then ran a school, a Protestant school there that many Americans have gone to over the years. Look, you know, I think that, and in fact, I've, you know, I say this all the time in our editorial meetings at CNN, that the issue of immigration, I think, is one of the great great issues, I think, in this country, and will be for the rest of this century. I don't think that I don't see how we move forward as a country in a really productive way without coming to terms with this and having, serious immigration reform. And the one thing that I think is really a shame right now, and certainly, you know, is part of, you know, my whole family history, is that, you know, when immigrants of this country embrace learning and, participate in our educational system and succeed in our educational system and want to advance in our educational system and stay here after they've had the benefits of our educational system, the fact that our current immigration laws make that difficult, I think, is a total scandal.
We are almost out of time. I want to ask you just quickly one last question, which is, what would you hope a reader would take away from your memoir?
Well, you know, ultimately, I talked about this earlier. This is my story is not an attempt to condemn or to feel sorry for myself or be too melodramatic. It's to understand. Ultimately, I think that it's where I come from as a reporter. But ultimately, I think it's very therapeutic, I think, not to just sort of put aside, you know, your feelings towards your parents, but to really try to understand where they came from and ultimately how that affected the family and the rest of your life.
Mark Whitaker, author of My Long Trip Home, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Susan, thanks for having me.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Constant Contact, supporting Small Business Saturday and committed to supporting small businesses every day. ConstantContact.com/Saturday. From the New York Community Trust, working with Lowell School to educate young people for a life of global citizenship in the 21st century. And from CenturyLink, providing broadband, entertainment, and voice products to Americans coast to coast. Learn more at CenturyLink.com. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, top journalists discuss the week's international news and why those stories matter. We take your calls, emails, and tweets so you become part of the conversation. Ask the questions you want answered. Join us each week for the Friday News Roundup.